on Web Radio, where we shine the positive light of Jesus Christ on music, scripture, community, and world issues. We're being broadcast from the awesome Skid Row Studios in beautiful downtown Los Angeles. If you would like to see our show live, go to skidrowstudios.com and hit live video. And now, our show.
I'm Shante Duncan.
And I'm Denise Boyd.
And you are listening to Positive Perspective. Before we start the show, wanted to congratulate three Americans who thwarted a potential terrorist attack in France. Their names are Spencer Stone, who is part of the Air Force, Alec Scarlatos, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, served on the Oregon National Guard, and Anthony Sadler, who is a college student. There was an attempted terrorist attack on a train in France, and these three Americans courageously were able to get a hold of the person that was trying to do this terrorist attack. And he had, I believe it said he had a shotgun and his weapons, a lot of weapons on him. One of the guys said his thumb was almost taken off by trying to stop them. So I just wanted to take a little time to congratulate them on their bravery and the amount of who knows how many lives they were able to save by acting quickly. I think Obama has already commemorated them, and they're supposed to have a banquet or something to just celebrate and commend some
and acts of bravery. I also want to add that when I heard this news, it said three Americans foiled this terrorist attack, not one African-American, black American, or two white Americans. It was three Americans that were brave, and that's how we represent. And I'm really proud of those young men. And I'm just throwing this out there. We don't need a label. We can be Americans. We all can be Americans. We just have to stand up and fight for that.
Okay. How about we go around and introduce ourselves, just get to know each other before we kind of get into the discussion. So we'll start with Lanisha.
I'm Nisha B.
I'm Pastor Del Castro.
Demetra Coulter.
Pastor Richard Ledesma.
Y'all know me.
Okay.
Denise
and I'm Shante, so thank you guys all for coming. Okay, there's a caller on the line. Hello?
Yes.
Hey, who do I have on the line?
Hello?
Yes. Who do I have on the line?
Miss Desiree?
Okay. Go ahead and throw it over to her.
Okay.
And then you take it over from there. That's your caller?
Okay.
I know.
She can still be part of the discussion.
Wait,
it's
maybe.
Fine.
Okay.
Good evening, everyone. This is Nisha B here tonight at Skid Row Studios doing a Positive Perspective show. I will be your host for one night only, and we'd like to discuss a topic that's very important in my life, in my childhood, in my present life, and in my children's life. And I'm pretty sure a lot of you callers out there will be able to relate to the topic that we'll be discussing tonight, which is addiction and how it affects the home, society, your childhood and everything above, I guess. So tonight I have with me Pastor Dell, who is a very active pastor with addiction.
Yeah, addiction, gang warfare in the communities of Riverside, Linden Empire.
Exactly. And I came about meeting Pastor Dell through my brother, who suffered from an addiction of meth. Previous to that, we grew up in a crack-addicted home, and it kind of tripled down from there, where each kid became dependent on a drug of choice. It wasn't the same for everyone. My brother at the time went further into his addiction. I found Victory Outreach. They took my brother in and they reformed him and showed him Christ and taught him how to love himself and how to put the Lord first and how to battle his addiction. Before I get into my particular childhood situation with the crack addiction, I want to focus on meth, because right now in this day and age, the meth epidemic is just ridiculous. We have states that are considered meth capitals of the world, like Utah, Idaho. Now it's becoming California, San Bernardino Mountains. A lot of the generations now and generations before me and even generations probably after me will be suffering from parents who are addicted to methamphetamines. And who I have on the line right now is a caller by the name of Desiree Ramos, who has a very, direct situation, right, Des? As far as what you know about methamphetamines, how it affected your childhood, the stigmas that come with it. Mm-hmm. Would you like to share anything about that tonight?
Hey.
Okay. Well, she'll be back with us in a second. But for now, I guess we'll just go back into the crack epidemic of what I want to talk about personally, because that's what I personally experienced throughout my childhood. That epidemic was about the mid-80s, 90s. It came through mostly in black communities and poverty-stricken communities, and it took everybody, took every child's parent away from them, basically, is how I looked at it. That's how we became where we're at now, as far as having our own codependencies and having our own addictions to handle. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to turn it over to Pastor Dell right now and have him give us a little background on what he knows about a family that suffers from addiction, the turmoil that the children go through, the battle and the struggle that the actual addict has to endure every single day. And his own personal experiences too, from his past.
Yes, I got involved in drug addiction at a very early age. I grew up in a Mexican community, a barrio, what we call it, in a neighborhood in Casablanca, right there in Riverside.
Yeah.
And Casablanca was known as a very notorious barrio that even the policemen were afraid to come and patrol it. It was a very tight-knitted neighborhood. Everybody knew each other. And it had a culture of its own. And everybody grew up going to the same elementary school. Mexicans and Africans, black Africans, mm-hmm. And so we really didn't even see the white folk until we went to junior high, outside of our neighborhood. And we started very young because I believe our role models were the ex-cons coming out of San Quentin, Soledad, and those were our heroes. I guess it would be like the same thing that in the other side of the tracks where you have the good families, you have the college kids, and excuse me, and you see them coming out of Harvard, Yale, and the kids, they see them as role models. Sorry.
It's all right, man. You don't need to do that. I'll just do it.
And And so, you know, growing up in the neighborhood, in the hood, we had our role models, and that's was our dream to one day hit the big house, you know, come out all tacked back, come out with respect, you know, that would be like our degrees, you know, and so forth. So we lived according to the code of the neighborhood, you know, taking care of our own, living, raising up the flag of the neighborhood, willing to die for the neighborhood. And along with all of that comes, of course, the drinking, the sex, the drugs, all growing up and doing all of that, you know.
So it was definitely mostly a social thing for that particular area.
Yes, uh-huh. And then, well, a lot of us seen our parents doing it and their grandfathers, so it was kind of like a generational curse down the line, you know. We just didn't know that there was another really type of life. And like when I started, you know, doing drugs, I started sniffing glue. At those times, there was airplane glue, Texters, Reval. You know, they would sell little package, little boxes of airplanes, model cars. But we won't do the model cars or the planes. We would just go and get the glue. And I remember that we started doing it on a sock or handkerchief and inhale the vapors and get real high. Then after that, we changed the method. We went into the bag, the lunch bag, and start putting in the lunch bag and sniffing it like that. And it would really make us hallucinate and mess us all up. And I know that a lot of us really burned a lot of our brain cells, you know, doing all
just
of that.
That alone.
Yeah, and then, well, after that, you know, you graduate into your pills, you graduate into your marijuana, and smoking marijuana at the age of 10, 12, you know, and then popping reds and rainbows and blue heavens and the whole nine yards, you know. And before I knew it, you know, I took my first fix at the age of 14, heroin. And that was the beginning of a whole different world, night
That's
world.
That's really young, 14 yeah. years old. Mm-hmm. So all that other stuff, like in this day and age, they say marijuana is the gateway drug.
Yeah.
Or whatever new drug comes on the market is the gateway drug.
Yeah.
But back then you had to resort to the things that you could just go get off the shelves.
Yes.
And that's how you started.
And you talk to any junkie, you know, every junkie smoked weed, you know, first, you know, and I don't know where this generation is going now. They legalize it and all of that. And
yeah.
So, see, I lived in Amsterdam because I got saved later on and went to the mission field. And I don't know, you remember the 60s. I grew up in the 60s, you know, drugs, sex, rock and roll. You know, it seems that the whole generation was lost and looking for identity, you know. And at that time, you know, Haight Ashbury, you know, love, peace, the hippies and all that. And after all that finished, all the hippies went to Amsterdam because that was a place where they can, you know, pot was legal and all of that, you know. And so I got to go over there as a missionary, and I seen what started here, legalizing pot. They tried it a long time ago over there, and they have created a numb generation that they would have to bring in, you know, people from other countries to do their labor, to do their work.
Yeah.
Because the whole generation just was stoned. And they didn't know how to work or anything. They just kicked back and just smoked weed. Yeah. So, you know, that's where I see this nation is going, you know. I know that a lot of it is, you know, for medical reasons or whatever, but...
You really think a lot of it's for medical reasons?
No. I know a lot of guys with those cars you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's really an epidemic today, you know. Our ministry, Victory Outreach, works in reaching the hardcores, you know, the gang members, the drug addicts, and now the meth, amphetamines, the speed freaks, and those that come whacked up and crack. It's a whole different thing. Because when I came, when we were working with drug addicts, it was like a physical thing. We're going through withdrawals and all of that. But now it's a psychological. It's a mental thing. And they can get violent.
Why do you think it's changed from the physical to the mental?
Because of the drug. Because of the chemicals. Yeah.
And a lot of it with the meth is, I know I watched a documentary not too long ago where it was speaking of meth starting in like the suburban neighborhoods. So you had like your soccer moms and your very prestigious moms using this drug so that they could endure more tasks throughout their day. Mm-hmm. And that was like a little secret, the little dirty secret of the suburbs. Mm. But so much focus was put on that. And maybe I'm wrong from the way I look at it, but the way I see it is, who cares? Because when you get down into the inner city, it's so abundant. Mm-hmm. And it's all you see. Just in my neighborhood alone where I live right now, I could walk out my door at any given minute and I could point out five what we call tweakers, meth addicts, you know? Back in my generation, it was the same thing. I could walk outside and all I had access to were crack cocaine addicts. But back then, what I would see with the difference between this generation and that generation is with crack cocaine, from my understanding, it was something you did. It was extremely addicting. And then you kept doing it for the need, for the dependency, as opposed to meth, where it's more of that mental need of wanting to accomplish more or be thinner or sex drive, whatever the reasons are, you know, behind it. But it seems like it's so advanced. It's so much more than what the crack epidemic was.
Right.
And then on top of that, you have the pills.
Yeah.
The Oxycontins and the, they don't exist anymore, but.
It's a lot of people now are hooked on prescription drugs. You know, a lot of prescription drugs, Oxycontin, Preludes and all, Quaaludes and all that. And like back in the 60s, you know, in the neighborhoods, you know, we had the marijuana and the heroin and the pills. But the champagne drugs were like in the high society, the cocaine. The cocaine for the rich people, cocaine. And they had made a way to come and break it down into crack so it can, you know, bring it down into the ghettos, you know. And now cocaine, crack, and all of that, I mean, you find it in elementary schools now.
Yeah,
you
really
know, and it's terrible. Crack babies, you know, pregnant women, all strung out, tweaked out, and having babies, and you know, it's very terrible. I myself, one of my boys, he was born, and his mother was addicted, you know, to heroin. She was in the, she was busted, you know, when she was pregnant, and she had him in the, she was incarcerated, and he came out strung out.
That was during the time yourself was clean, and doing the ministry and everything.
Yeah, I got saved in 1976, you know, and I've been serving the Lord since then, you know, and I have seen many, many of my homeboys, homegirls that are doing life in prison now, or most of them are all dead. And if it wasn't for the Lord coming into my life back then, I would be dead. I have this scar on my right hand, right side, that it reminds me of the grace and mercies of God. When one day they usher me into the Orange Girls with a sawed-off shotgun to the back of my head and a 9mm to my temple.
Wow.
They were going to kill me. But because of a praying mother, a praying church, you know what? That guy could not pull the trigger. And by the mercies of God, I escaped that ordeal. And 3 months later, rededicated my life to the Lord. And that brother that was going to kill me came into the center where I was at. And I ended up praying for him, forgiving him, and leading him into the Lord.
Yes.
Yeah, so the power of God is powerful. That's why when we go into the neighborhoods, to the hardcore neighborhoods, guys that think that they don't have no hope, I just show them my tracks in my arms. You know, my tracks, and I was there, you know, and God delivered me instantly. I had one of those Damascus experiences when I came into a rehabilitation home. Mm-hmm. God delivered me like that. I didn't go through no withdrawals or anything. So I knew.
And that's the biggest blessing of it all, because the relapse is almost inevitable.
Oh, yeah.
At least for a couple of years.
You feel like banging your head in the wall just to get a little peace of mind. You know?
Yes.
Terrible. Terrible.
Indeed, you had some experience yourself, right?
Well, not myself.
But, indirect experience.
Yes, yeah. My father, he was addicted to crack cocaine for a little over 20 years. I didn't live with my father. I had a, you know, we lived with my mother and my stepfather, and he lived with his wife and their family. But I didn't even know, well, me and my siblings, we didn't know that he had this problem until, you know, he stopped showing up for visits. You know, he would say, I'm on my way, and just wouldn't show up. Now, I was about 15, 16 at the time, so really didn't register to me what was going on. And then one day we got the call from his wife, who explained it to my mother, and then she, you know, explained it to my siblings and I what was going on. And then from that point, it was just, I mean, it was an eye-opening experience. For one, my father was a prominent businessman, very upstanding, you know, devoutly religious. And it was just hard for us to really ascertain him doing something like that. It just went against everything he's ever taught us, everything, you know, he believed in. But, you know, when he was sober, because he's sober now, he's been sober for quite a few years, you know, we had a chance to ask him what happened. And he said, really, when his mother passed, which was his whole world, then his father passed like a year and a half later. It was just too much for him. It was just devastating. And then I guess he was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
Going through, you know, all the mental devastation and just heartbreak. And there it was. He said, one hit.
And there you have it.
But
and
you
there
said it was. He was a Christian or a devout religious, or was he a Christian at that time?
No,
my
father's, he's a Muslim. He has been since he was 19. So he just, I mean, just very regimented, very disciplined. It was just like I said.
But without the spirit of power of Christ.
Yeah.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And what did he start using?
I was about, I guess, 15, 16. So he was, older 40s, maybe.
No, I meant what kind of drugs
He
get into?
It was crack cocaine.
Okay.
Yes. Uh-huh.
About around the same time, Eric. Mm-hmm. We're not too much different in the
80s. So, yeah, it was the 80s. Yeah, it was the 80s. So, it was a little bit of an embarrassment for my siblings and I because, again, like I said, my father was this, and he is now, an upstanding individual. And so just to know the whole family, cousins and everyone knew that's what he was doing. And, you know, it was almost like shame. It was just shameful. Like, oh my God, that's my father. He's, you know, in that condition.
He's a junkie.
Pretty much, you know, and it's just to see him having, you know, his own business, money from every pocket to nothing was devastating.
So for a while he was very functional in his addiction, right?
Yes, because he was able to hide it. But once my stepmother, you know, told us what was going on, then it's like all the clues start to come together, the puzzles, like, oh, that's why if I was talking to him, he was, hey. And then he turned around, he's asleep. You know, you just start putting all the pieces together. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of with the way it happened in my childhood with that particular drug, is my father was always a drug addict. I didn't know anything other, you know, from him other than that. My mother was a very career-minded and business-oriented executive working for California Federal, own office, Cadillacs. We had everything. It was actually my father who got my mother on drugs. And it was one of those things, from my understanding, I could be wrong, but as an adult looking back at it, I figure it was one of those, I can't beat this. Let me see what it's about. Let me see what the big deal is. It's as a kid, it seemed like it was an overnight process from going from a regular family, because even though my dad was an addict, my mother kept our home very up to par. You know, we had the best of everything, and she compensated for everything my dad lacked as a parent. And so when that drastic change came about of both of them now being addicts, everything that comes with that was automatic. The stigma, the depression as a child, the confusion, the in and out of custody battles, and all of that stuff. And what amazes me is that to this day, neither one of them can admit, because they truthfully don't believe, it's not that they're lying to themselves, they really don't believe that their addictions had anything to do with who we are as adults or teenagers or even back then as children, you know. And what it did to me was actually put me in a situation to where addiction was so normal for me. All my friends were addicts. My boyfriends were addicts, you know. And then I ended up ultimately marrying an alcoholic who is now fighting and struggling to recover, you know. But now that I look back on us meeting, us being together, I could see that it was my own stigmas and characteristics of being a child of addicts to where I was drawn to him. You know, I can't explain it more than that. I would need a doctor. But,
Lanisha, I've known you for many years. And you were very young, weren't you? Like 5 when your mom and dad got hooked on the drugs?
Yeah, well, my dad, like I said, all my life, but I remember seeing my mother do it for the first time. I was about 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were having a very big party at my house, and I walked in on it, and it wasn't until the aftermath mm-hmm. to where I realized what she was doing.
Now, I know you for a long time, too, as well.
Yes, you have.
And I don't know. I believe, like you say, a drawn to, which is my son. I'm Derek's father.
And he is my husband. He's an awesome guy. Thank you,
yes.
By the way.
And I don't know. I don't see it like that. And I don't know. But you guys, to me, were just kids. And it's because Derek wasn't really, at that time, he didn't seem like he was addicted to things. He was just addicted to trying to rap and be in that thing. And I think it was pretty just normal that, you know, you guys hooking up. So, I mean, when you say you are drawn to an addicted person, I don't know. Can you break that down?
Oh, sure. You're totally right. In the beginning, no, it wasn't the fact that, you know, I sensed that he would one day become an alcoholic. However, very early in our relationship, we both were avid drinkers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we would go nowhere without drinking.
Who didn't?
But I think you guys also did what the pastor said, did a very good job of functioning and covering it up.
Yeah, well, with me, I knew nothing about alcoholism. Like, and because when you're the child of addicts, hardcore addicts, you look at alcoholism as minute. Mm-hmm.
Oh,
it's nothing.
Can't compare.
Like, exactly.
Yeah. At least
so
it's
you
not
think.
Drugs. You know, I mean.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you when you got with your husband?
I was 16 years old when we got together. I was about 20 when I realized he had a drinking problem.
Is that when you started drinking when you were 16?
Yeah. I've always started drinking, because with me, my drinking started with my drinking and my other experimenting with other things here and there was off to self-medicate. I was unhappy. I was had a lot of mental problems that no adult wanted to accept that I had. So no one gave me the attention in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And the alcohol made me happy.
So
you know,
how
the weed
did
made
you,
me happy.
How did you get a hold of it? I mean, obviously, I know you can get a hold of it, but I mean, it sounds like you were doing a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
So how was it so accessible to you?
Oh, it's even in this day and age, mm-hmm. it's so easy to get a hold of alcohol. You know, your parents have alcohol mm-hmm. cabinets.
Mm-hmm.
Every friend I had, whether they were poor, middle class, rich, their parents had a bar, you know.
And I can say that's true, because when we cleaned the alcohol out, when we realized it, I don't know how many bottles because we didn't use alcohol much, they were filled with water.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and we didn't realize that.
Yes.
You know, and once we didn't even think were open that had gotten as gifts and stuff that you just stick in the cabinet under the sink type
of
thing.
No, because you're not going to ever think your kid's going to go under there and make a cocktail, you know?
And that's what I was going to ask the pastor, too. When you said you were over, I guess, overseas in Amsterdam, the locals were so high they couldn't work. So how did they afford the drugs?
Well, it's a social country, and they would support it.
The
drug addicts, all they had to do is give them an address, and they would send them a check.
Wow. Mm.
And also, after that, porn and everything that you can think of is there.
Legalized.
And I think, and it's really overwhelming me with L.A., that's where we're headed.
That's where they're headed. And right, you know, like, my wife ministered in the red light district. You know, she's a Colombian, my wife, and she had a team, an evangelistic team, and she would take a team into the red light district. They had a section that all the Africans were at, all the Dutch were at, all the South America, all the ones from the Caribbean. They had them from the ages of 14, 15, all the way to grandmas on rocking chairs. All the way to grandmas on rocking chairs. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, so anything your fancy mind could imagine, mm-hmm. it was there. It was there. And they seen it as a job because it was run by the government. Mm. The husband would leave her wife at the red light district so she can put her 8 hours work.
Wow.
And then pick her up and go home, have dinner with the kids and everything like a normal job.
Wow. Well, I see society that the schools are breaking our children down mentally to accept mm-hmm. this thing. And it's right. like the homosexuality and right. all these things are accepted. And if you say anything against it, then they get mm-hmm. offended and they come unglued about it.
Now also, they have this red light district and they can have a McDonald's and a hardcore pornography shop right in front.
Right? Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Probably right next to the elementary school.
And the kids
exactly.
are immune.
Yeah.
And that they're used to seeing that.
Right.
You know? Like mm-hmm. Nanisha and was saying. They have a section where all the homosexuals, Rembrandt's Plain, what they call it.
Mm-hmm.
And on Queen's Day, everything shuts down and it's like a Mardi Gras. It's like Sodom mm-hmm. and Gomorrah.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody just walking around, you know.
That's where we're headed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's almost like our government is saying, we're not going to control the moral aspect of your life. So therefore, morally, if you feel it's okay to stay drugged, intoxicated, homosexual, whatever your get down is,
mm-hmm.
it's your prerogative.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they feel it's against an amendment, right, to tell us you can't indulge in these things, but it mm-hmm. could be regulated. Mm-hmm. Even with the medical cannabis, with the pharmaceuticals, just with my husband's illness, I feel that he gets way too much opiates for his mm-hmm. condition. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even go through all of them for his pain, and he stays in pain, you know? And it's like, why are you giving him so many pills?
Mm-hmm. Well, he can sell them.
but you know,
introduce a whole other set of problems.
But you know that is so true, that because I can remember just going to the dentist and having a tooth pulled, and she says, you know, what kind of medication you want? You want Tylenol with codeine? I go, oh, I'm allergic to codeine. Okay, let me just give you some Norcos. How many would you like? I'm like, you know, it doesn't hurt. I'll just take, you know,
yeah.
I'll just take some Tylenol. I'll be cool with that and stuff. Yeah. But I mean, yeah. something as simple as to me as having a tooth pulled,
right.
they're ready to give you some kind of a pain pill.
Oh, yeah.
You have
yeah.
something major, they're going to write you out 6 months supply.
Exactly. And that's how it comes to that question of how are we, the kids, getting a hold of this stuff, because it's just so much of it out there. And then you have the irresponsible adult who's like, oh, well, I still do it. And when I was younger, I wanted someone to hook me up. So, mm-hmm. hey, I'll go buy mm-hmm. your beer, or I'll give you a sack of weed.
Yeah, we used to do that in middle school. Pills. The kids would be able to get alcohol really easy. Just ask a homeless man, and they'll give him money or whatever he wanted, and he would help them out.
And it's that thing, he doesn't even have to be homeless sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. But I was like, I thought it was really weird that they would do that. It was really easy for them to get.
Really?
Yeah, that was the first time I saw it, and I was like in 6th or 7th grade.
We did it all the time.
A wino in the neighborhood. And if you got him a bottle, he got you what you wanted.
Yeah.
But see, when I was 16 or so, we hid it. Like you said, we hid it.
Oh,
but these kids nowadays, they're just, hey.
Bold.
Yeah, they're very bold.
Well, they don't have to be anything but that.
Yeah.
But it's a generation that's going out now if you notice the way it is that I can do whatever I want to do. If you got a problem with it, turn your head the other way.
Right.
And so they don't feel they have to hide anything.
Or don't you dare say anything to me about it.
Yeah.
Mind your own business. This postmodernism that there's no absolute truth.
Right.
It's absolutely no absolute. Relativism. Right. Mm-hmm. What's right for you may not be right for me.
Right.
There's no one truth.
Mm-hmm.
And what's true for you may not be true to me. So don't get in my case. You do
right.
your thing. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we have a caller on the air with a question.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes.
Hi.
My name is Amanda, and I'm calling because your guest, Demetra, I think she said her name was talking about her father and that he got on drugs and he was 40 years old. And she said that he was a Muslim. And then the pastor, I don't know if he implied that because he believes in Allah instead of Jesus Christ, that he was able, you know, was weak and took the drugs because he didn't have Christ in his life. So I'm saying if he's implying that, how does he account for the first 40 years of his life where he didn't take drugs? Because I have friends of all religions, and I'm religious myself, and I believe that whatever people are, whatever their faith is, whether it be Allah, Buddha, whatever, then that's what they believe. And they should be strong in that faith. And just because you're not a Christian doesn't mean you're going to be weak to everything. So I don't know if he's implying that because he didn't believe in Christ, per se, Jesus Christ, that he's going to be weak forever.
No, I didn't get that same point from the comment he made, but I know this is a Christian talk show, and we do know from our experience, individual experiences, that when a person is brought to Christ and they're shown the right way and they're shown how to let the Lord take control of their life and lead them in the right direction, then that addiction does become diluted, and that desire to have a drug eventually goes away because of the power of Christ. Now, I personally think, yeah, regardless of any religion you are, you could be Hindu, Buddhist, you know, whatever, you're still going to, you could struggle with the drug and you could still conquer the drug. But as a Christian woman myself, my first thing would be to direct you to the Lord when you have a struggle. But at the same time, like I said, that doesn't mean that just because you're a Muslim, you're going to still stay on drugs.
Yeah, and I mean, I throw it out there because there's no power like Christ. There is none like him. There is nothing, absolutely no one like him. He is God. And in my life, I've seen what he's done in my life. And there's a lot of people can attest to what he's done in their lives. When I say Muslim, I don't believe that. They believe that God is Jesus is a prophet. And,
right.
And you know, that's just what they believe. But like Lanisha's saying, you can believe in hopscotch, and that can get you off of a drug. But when you turn your life over to Christ Jesus, he can take it from you, and that's where I was coming from.
Yeah, and just to be clear, my father, he still is a very devout Muslim. And to everyone's point, you know, hopscotch and Jesus Christ and all of that, I believe as long as you do have a higher power, you know, regardless of what it is, you know, you're going to feel accountable to that higher power. And if you really do have the desire, which he did, to, you know, to free himself of the addiction, I think it's possible. Well, I can say I know it's possible because I did witness him. He just stopped.
Because at the end of the day, it's all about that desire, you know?
Right.
But the strength, when you want that strength and you want that struggle and that obstacle to be knocked out efficiently, like, and just never come back and be strong in your sobriety, you know, my personal view is you need to grab a hold of Christ because, you know, but for each their own, but not for me. That's all I can say.
Okay, well, I understand that. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much for sharing your point of view on that. That was, you know, interesting.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. You know, I would like to end the show if it's about that time.
15 minutes.
Okay. My main focus of this show wasn't really how to get off drugs or a method for sobriety. I want to concentrate on the stigmas that the children have to endure to stop the cycle from keep going, you know? The children of crack addicts are now the parents of children who have to watch them do meth, you know, or be on other drugs or alcoholics or whatever the case may be. And there's programs like Victory Outreach. I have a few programs that I wrote down that I just found on the internet, actually, that were safehouse.com, secondchoiceforlife.com. These are all ministries that don't just help the addict, they help the entire family. It's there's codependency issues with a spouse who can be a non-addict that can still enable her or his spouse to still do drugs. There's things like that that need to be addressed. There's issues with children who are watching things that we think that they're totally oblivious to, and they're not. They see everything, they sense everything, and by the time they're 15, 16 years old, what they didn't know at 5, they know now. And it's just something that needs to be addressed, and there's programs out there to help. When I was coming up, when Dee was coming up, we didn't have Christian, Muslim, any type of religious groups to come rescue our parents. They were far and few in between. We had the courts.
Yeah.
And because you loved your parent, you lied about their addiction because you didn't want CPS knocking at your door. Mm. You know, you didn't want to walk outside and go to school and everyone say your mom or your dad was a crackhead. So there's things that come along with that to where I just want to address that. I want to focus on how to reverse that. Like even with Victory Outreach, I know there's programs that you guys have to where you take a hold of the family, not just the addict.
Right. Well, you know, it's just like my brother was saying, you know, the Lord in John 8, I believe it's in that chapter where it says, who the Son sets free is free indeed. You know, and he says in another verse that when he was telling them that he was going to prepare a place for you, where I go, you know, I'll take you. And Thomas says, where are you going? We don't know where you're going. He says, well, he tells them, I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life. When he says, I am the way, you see, there's another scripture in Proverbs where it says, there seems to be a way that it seems right to man.
To a man. Mm-hmm.
But at the end, it's destruction.
Mm-hmm. To death. Yeah.
It's death. And then he says, I am the truth, not a truth. Mm-hmm. He says mm-hmm. the truth, and that's a definite article. And then he says, I am the life. And there really is no other life outside of Jesus Christ. Outside of Jesus Christ, I found myself that I was just existing. I was dead in my sin until I recognized that I was a sinner, that something was wrong with me. And the only one that can fill that void is not religion. It's not a man, mm-hmm. but it's only the Son of God. Mm-hmm. And when I came, something bear witness in my spirit that I am a child of God, because his spirit bears witness with my spirit that we are the sons of God. And therefore, I know that now I have eternal life. You see, and you go to Buddha, his body is still there, or now bones or dust, whatever. You go to Muhammad, he's still also the same thing. There was only one man in all history that said, I am deity. I am God. That's why they killed him. The religious leader killed him because he came to destroy their religious system. And when he came, he said, destroy this temple. I'll raise it up in 3 days. And he has been the only man in all of history that had been killed and he resurrected from the dead. Mm-hmm. You know, and it says, I am the resurrection. I am alive. So it's like Pasquale's wager, that it would be best that the common sense to believe in this man, because if you don't, then you have everything to lose. Mm. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But if he's right, I have everything to gain.
Everything.
Because all of us at one time, all man is we have to face a judgment. After that, after we die, we have to face a judgment. And so I came to a place in my life that I have found life. I have found the way, and I have found the truth.
Yes. So through Victory Outreach, do you also reach out to the spouses, the children, have programs there to help them also?
Yes, we do have all of that, and it's just part of the promise that God sells. When we get saved, the curse of the law is broken, that now my children don't have to be a crack addict. They don't have, they can't, I mean, they don't have to now be raised by crackheads' parents. Now they can be children that can live a normal life and grow up in a good, healthy home with a productive father and a mother.
And I mean, he says that, and like you say, there's a higher power, or we were saying about different forms of reform.
Right.
In a Muslim household, you know, once somebody makes up their mind to straighten up, the same can apply to their children. Once they decide to make up their minds to straighten up, then that's going to trickle down and affect their children and everyone else in a good way. But what the pastor is saying is that the evidence that Jesus Christ is the Lord and Savior, there's evidence of that. Through history, and I say history because we can look at it, and also prophecy. But history is good to look at because the evidence of his words and his power are there. It's we can't argue it. We can choose to ignore it, but we cannot argue it, and that is a better way.
And that's the hope that we have, that our children, we work with the children, we work with the teenagers. We have a ministry called GANG, because it relates to the ministry, to the people that we reach out, GANG.
I love that ministry.
You know, and it stands for God's Anointed Now Generation. Mm-hmm. That's an acronym, GANG. And people, the young kids, have the passion. And it's great that they're 13, 12, 14, and they're having a great time in the Lord. They're drug-free. They have a life of success. Many of them are going to be enrolling into college and finding their calling as a missionary, as a pastor. And so where before, if it wasn't for the Lord, they would be repeating that cycle.
Mm-hmm. And how do you reach out to them?
We go share the gospel to them. Pray for them, share with them from our heart how God changed our lives, and the Holy Spirit is the one that speaks to their heart.
Yeah.
I think for kids that are raised in houses where there's addiction, whether it's alcohol, drugs, or whatever, when somebody is talking to them that's like you have, Pastor, that's walked in those shoes and now say, look at me now. To me, it would just feel like it makes so much of a bigger impact than for somebody like me that wasn't raised in that kind of a household. I don't have any experience with that. And so I can try to talk and try to say, you know, I understand what you're doing, but I may not really understand because I've never lived that lifestyle.
Yeah.
And you can have all the knowledge and have all the degrees behind you and read all the books of sociology, psychology, and all of that human behavior and all of that. But when somebody comes and shares with you that they've been there, done
actual
that.
Actual experience.
That speaks volumes.
Yeah. Yeah. And they understand that it's not, you're not just fronting. They know that you're, by your words and actions, that you know what's going on.
Right, and then you come speak to a junkie and they say, well, what do you know?
Yep,
you don't know
exactly
what it means to be sick or like that. Yeah. Oh, yes, I do, buddy.
Because you've been in those shoes.
Exactly. Even as a child, you feel that way. When other people from their childhood, same age or generation, try to, you know, comment on how you should feel or the stigmas that you carry, it's like you can't go there. Mm-hmm. You know, until you've known what it's like to live with an addict of any sort, to go through the mood swings and the alternation of their personalities is the most mind-boggling and it's horrible. It's really hard for a child to wrap their mind around, this is how my parent is supposed to be, but this is how my parent is now. And there's no association between characters. Like, they're two different people. That alone is so traumatizing, you know? And I think, like I said earlier, it has to be addressed more. It has to be more programs out there. And that's why I love Victory Outreach, because I see what you guys do. I don't personally belong to your congregation. Mm-hmm. I visit your church from time to time. But I've seen what you did with my brother, who I thought would never come back. Yeah. I thought my brother was gone. I was ready to write him off. And I know he's not embarrassed by anything I'm saying, because he knows where he's come from.
And I can, you know, I can back Lanisha up, because we had conversations where it was, I'm never speaking to him again.
Exactly.
It's like, right. You can't do that. And to see when I saw them back together again after he got straightened out was, it was just, it was a blessing.
Right. It was.
And, you know, in the beginning, it wasn't easy because it was, we were coming from traditional churches.
Mm-hmm.
And God spoke to our founder. God spoke to, I want you to open a church for drug addicts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I said, what do you mean a church for drug addicts, you know?
It's like an oxymoron. Like, what are you talking about?
Sin is sin. That's just a sin they have. It's and so now, different than other
he
sin.
He didn't realize, but now we see it. Now we're all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's almost been 50 years. We're in Africa, South America, New Zealand, Australia.
And
the same people we find all over the world, the same people like us here in the United States.
And on that note right there is one of the things that I wanted to end the show with, because anyone out there that's listening, no matter where you're at, even different countries, this ministry, along with other ones, but this is the one I'm knowledgeable of, their doors open.
Yes.
Their homes are open. Their programs are open. And there's no reason to have to keep going through the life of addiction and the life of turmoil and trauma and everything else.
Yes.
Pastor, can you give us information on how to get the best way to contact you?
They can visit our website, which is www.victoryvoriverside.com. V-O, like for Victory Outreach, riverside.com. Or they can go to our main one, which is victoryoutreach.org.
Yes.
And that would point them to the closest one in their neighborhood.
All the ones that we have. All the rehabilitation homes and all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're winding down on time, but I was wondering if there's like some last messages that any of you would like to leave to listeners out there that may be struggling with addiction or have family, friends, close loved ones that are struggling, if you can offer a quick message.
Well, if I can leave anything with the audience that is listening, you know, I don't know where you're at, what situation is happening with you, your family, whatever.
Okay, we got to wind it down.
Yeah, but Jesus Christ is the answer.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ is the answer. That's all I can say.
Final comments?
I would also like to say, you know, just very briefly, from my father's experience, he's been clean for quite a while now, but he is very open and honest about his situation, and he always takes the opportunity to reach out to people who are struggling, who may be struggling, and he shares his story with them so that they can draw something from it, because
that's,
we know,
awesome.
In the Bible it says, you know, use your bones as testimonies to help other people. So
that's great.
Yes.
Is there a number that we can reach you?
I can be reached at 951-809-3848 if anybody has any questions or anything like that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And I would just like to say I could be reached by email. I really have no expertise at all, but I can listen, I can direct, I can find resources. That's what I do, and I can blast the internet with any type of information that could be considered a resource. So you can reach me at lanishaboyd@gmail.com, and that's LaNishaBoyd. Okay, I forgot there for a second.
I just want to thank you all for joining us tonight. Great conversation. Wanted to end with the message that we are never more like our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ than when we are loving, creating, and forgiving. Thank you so much, Lanisha. You did a great job as just hosting this show. I'm sure a lot of listeners appreciate it. So thank you so much for tuning in to Positive Perspective.
Thank you.